Hello, blogging heads, and welcome to another week of This Week in Blog. Today, Bill is out, and I have Ari Melber, who is the net movement correspondent for Nation Magazine. I first got to know Ari when I had a very similar beat for the hotline at the Blogometer. So we got to know each other professionally then, and he was more than happy to fill in for Bill today. So welcome, Ari.
Thank you.
We're taping on Thursday here, and we both agree that the nomination is pretty much over, so we're going to skip pretty much all talk of Clinton and head right to general election stuff. Starting with John McCain starting to shore up his conservative base with a big speech on Tuesday, the very day of the primaries, on what type of justices he wanted to appoint to the court. And John McCain does not have a lot of issues which with the conservative base trusts him on, but this is quickly becoming one of them. At the corner, Catherine Jean Lopez had a post titled "The Supreme Bush Legacy, Alito and Roberts," and then she posted the text of McCain's speech approvingly. And from red state to town hall, pretty much everyone was very pleased with what McCain said. Even Michelle Malkin was pleased with what he said. But Michelle, of course, is very tough on Republicans, especially ones that go against the immigration line. And she also posted text of his speech, but then also asked questions for discussion, do you trust him? And then she linked to articles about the Gang of 14 and a quote from McCain saying that he did vote for Roberts. He would appoint someone like Roberts, but that someone like Alito was a little too extreme because they, quote, you know, wore their ideology, their conservatism on their sleeve.
Right.
So that's pointing out that McCain in the past does have a history of not appreciating conservative justices the way conservatives want him to. And I'm sure the reaction on the left was somewhat different.
Yeah, well, I think the reaction on the left is different. I think in the blogosphere, of course, as you mentioned, there's been so much more attention on the Democratic race. But I actually was surprised a little bit in reading Town Hall and Red State and how easy McCain got off. Because if you look at the speech itself, it was not a serious speech. He didn't really articulate a specific judicial philosophy, and he didn't really dig into very many cases. In fact, the Supreme Court cases he mentioned were gimmies, you know, across the spectrum. Takings jurisprudence in Kelo and
Newdow,
the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, those aren't really, to my mind, strong conservative cases for outrage. They're really issues that cut across the political spectrum. So it was very safe in that regard, and it wasn't precise.
He's not going to cite McCain-Feingold.
No, he's not going to cite areas where the Supreme Court has not gone 100% his way, although, of course, parts of McCain-Feingold did remain intact.
Right, well, but, you know, he's not going to go to a conservative audience and talk about how happy he is that the court upheld many aspects of McCain-Feingold.
Right, right. But I also think that, you know, what was left unsaid here was something that is a key issue for at least traditional libertarian conservatives as well as independents, and that is the excesses and, you know, basically abuse of executive power of the Bush administration. I mean, he didn't discuss at all the issues around detention, domestic spying, executive power, signing statements. And while many people in the, you know, grassroots part of the Republican base see those as issues of standing by President Bush, and we've seen that for years now, there are people, whether you go out to, you know, the intellectual folks at Cato, or the grassroots folks who were supporting Ron Paul, some of whom are obviously conservatives that could support a Republican candidate, there's a lot of concern about that. So he didn't dig into that at all. I mean, here you have, for example, with the Bush administration making the really unheard-of claim that they could detain American citizens without trial in the Hobby case. Very controversial for a lot of conservatives as well as everybody else.
Which they lost.
Which they lost, exactly. So there you have, that's the question. I mean, we want to talk about what's always the issue in the courts is the close cases. And they lost narrowly on that. A lot of Republicans and Federalist Society folks talk about a more robust view of executive power that might allow that kind of thing, basically snatching Americans up off the street and not giving them the rights they've had for 200 years.
Yeah, I don't
years.
Think that is mainstream at all in even Federalist Society pictures. I would recommend Peter Bernstein's book, readings. It's a collection of readings from the post-war period. It includes Hamdi and the rest of it. It has a bunch of conservative scholars. It's a good sampling of what is conservative opinion when it comes to Hamdi and those slew of cases. And you know, even among conservatives, the being able to swoop in and get American citizens, which was key for Scalia. Remember, Scalia was
sure.
was definitely against that part of it. You know, that's everything to him. That you definitely cannot do that to an American citizen. Yeah, conservatives are definitely not on board with that.
Well, but I would say you're definitely right, and Scalia did, you know, depart there. But on the Rasool and Hamdan decisions, both about rights to habeas corpus for detainees, in those cases relating to Guantanamo, you had pretty, you know, close decisions there. So if we're talking about the mainstream of conservative jurists, you're talking about most of the conservative members of the court wanting to go the other way.
Yeah, I would just make this point. You talk about, you know, economic conservatives being somewhat worried about McCain. I would say it's all about priorities and realizing that in any election you're not going to have a perfect choice of options. And my point would be this. For people whose priorities are more economic liberties as opposed to civil liberties, you know, what's so far come out of Obama is much, much worse than what's come out of McCain. You know, McCain quoted Obama from his speech. You know, Obama said he would support judges that made decisions on cases from one's deepest values, one's core concerns, one's broader perspective of how the world works, and the depth and breadth of one's empathy. So not the merits of the case, but just, you know, one's empathy.
You don't like empathy, Con?
I
had no idea.
I think empathy is fine and great for, you know, legislators.
Uh-huh.
But on the court, I want people who will apply the law. Or, you know, Michael Goldfarb at the Weekly Standard had a great parsing of David Axelrod's response to the same speech. Axelrod told MSNBC, "Barack Obama has always believed that our courts should stand up for social and economic justice." Well, you know, what is the social justice that David Axelrod is talking about? Well, when we go to Barack Obama's website, as Goldfarb points out, we see that Obama talks about social justice in this light. This is from Obama's own words. "More fundamentally, the discomfort of some progressives with any hint of religion has often prevented us from effectively addressing issues in moral terms. Some of the problem here is rhetorical. If we scrub language of all religious content, we forfeit the imagery and terminology which millions of Americans understand both our personal morality and social justice." So Goldfarb then goes on to say, "So Obama wants judges who apply their religious beliefs to interpreting the law?" And, you know, this is definitely something that's going to concern economic libertarians and definitely conservatives, because we definitely do not want judges ignoring the law and just deciding the case on whichever plaintiff is the cutest and provides the most empathy. That, you know, that's not law. That's American Idol.
Well, I doubt that quote was with regard to jurisprudence guidance for members of the court. It sounds more like the language that you use and the values that you invoke when trying to build a movement. I think Obama has proven to be very successful at that on the political side. I do agree with you that we want judges to use different standards. And that brings us to another point in the McCain speech. He talked a lot about quote-unquote judicial activism. And, you know, you and I were emailing about that in advance. I found that, again, really striking. He took the easy way out. He didn't dig in and explain what he meant by that, but he used code words. And for many people on the right, I don't have to tell you or anyone visiting this website, we all know that refers to abortion jurisprudence. It refers to a lot of equal rights advancements that basically people think the courts were getting out there and ahead of the American public. The problem, of course, is when you dig into this with any factual basis, you find that it is overwhelmingly Republican appointees to the courts that are engaging in the activism. And so I sent you this in advance. I wanted to have a little C-SPAN moment, even though we're doing blogging heads. I'm going to hold up here an excellent factual guide on the actual members of the Supreme Court that have been overturning the most laws passed by the democratically elected representatives of the people. What you see there, and these numbers will be available, we'll do a link as well. This is from a study at Yale. is that overwhelmingly conservative members of the court are the ones engaging in activism, if you define it by using the power of the court to overturn democratic legislative initiative. So I think that is kind of an interesting counterpoint to the code words of activism, whatever that means. Here, if activism means overturning the will of the people, it's actually the conservatives on the court who've been doing that the most. It's a fact.
Yeah, and, you know, I would just quibble with the whole definition of activism as overturning the legislature. I actually blogged about this on Wednesday after the New York Times editorialized on it, because this is the quote from the New York Times editorial. Mr. McCain did not mention, of course, how the Roberts-led court blithely overruled Congress by nullifying a key part of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. He did wax nostalgic about what the basic right of property has meant since the founding of America. And then the New York Times has a parenthetical. He did not mention that in 1789, many women could not own property and that African Americans were property, but he did criticize the idea that values evolve over time. And so my blogging response was, is the New York Times really this ignorant? Are they completely unaware that strict constructionalism does not forbid and in fact requires the Supreme Court to overturn congressional legislation when it does not conform to the Constitution? Are they completely unaware that strict constructionism depends upon the ability of people to amend the Constitution? Are they completely unaware that the Supreme Court did not free the slaves or grant the women right to vote, and that constitutional amendments did those things in the 13th and 19th Amendment, respectively? And I think this comes down to the whole point of what conservatives, when they talk about judicial activism, means, is that if Congress wants to go ahead and, you know, invent, you know, trimesters and legislate on abortion, et cetera, Congress should go ahead and do that. But to have nine judges divine from, you know, the 14th Amendment and the Constitution that the founders had these, knew what trimesters were, and create an abortion right centered around these trimesters is completely preposterous. And the strict constructionism depends upon courts overturning laws. So using overturning laws as a rubric is completely ridiculous.
I don't think it's ridiculous, although I agree with you it's not the only metric. But it is one metric of how active the court is. I mean, it's not, for example, this Yale study that started with the activism. That, of course, is coming out of a political discourse that's emphasized it and used it as a code word. But I think anyone would agree that, yes, bad laws and unconstitutional laws have to be overturned. I do think it's striking, though, that folks who talk about limited government, who talk about a strict judicial philosophy, are the ones finding the most opportunities and the most frequent need to overturn the will of the legislature. By the way, that includes, of course, times when the Congress was controlled by Republicans and the bills were passed by a majority of Republican support still being overturned. So, no, I agree it's not that simple, but I'm glad you mentioned, you know, what the strict constructionism mean. The other link I want to draw people to is a fascinating new study by Richard Posner, who's perfect for us. He's a blogger. But he's also, of course, a federal appeals court judge appointed by President Reagan and considered, as everyone knows, a fascinating person whether you agree with him or disagree. But since we're reading things, his new study talks about how basically the conservative originalism or textual originalism, looking towards what Scalia and other folks have been, you know, really successfully pushing on the court, has, and I'm quoting now, a backward orientation that actually enlarges a judge's legislative scope, and not only by concealing that he is legislating. A judge or justice who's out of step with current precedents reaches back to some earlier body of case law, and the older bedrock, the older the case law or underlying statutory or constitutional language, basically, quote, the greater the scope for manipulation of the meaning in the name of historical reconstruction, or intellectual archaeology. Basically, what he's getting at is a lot of conservative jurists, of which he is one, reach back into history and strict constructionalism because there are political goals that they like that are rooted in those historical periods. And this is not just speculation. It's a study. We'll link to it. And the data that he pulls basically shows that over time, we've seen an increase in this politicization. And here's the stats. According to Posner, Republican-appointed federal judges from 1925 to 2002 voted what he calls conservative about 55% of the time. Current Republican appointees vote conservative about 66% of the time, more than their Republican predecessors, and more, it turns out, than Democrats vote liberally Democratic-appointed judges. Again, that's not the end of the argument because cases are complicated, but there's clearly a politicization of the courts. And I think if you look at this data and you look at the use of textualism, originalism, it is coming from the right. That's where the judicial activism and the political retrenchment is, not from the center or the left. And that's where I think, unfortunately, although John McCain may have pleased some people with that speech, he was wrong on the facts.
I don't have a rebuttal. My response would just be, first of all, as a graduate of George Mason's Law and Economics School, Posner is definitely one of our heroes. I'm a big fan. However,
so
like
I brought the right guy to the conversation.
Yeah, the cases are complicated, and I would hesitate to call what he has data there. But I think definitely when you look at decisions by justices, sometimes I would say there have been times when conservative justices who use strict constructionist rhetoric have let me down. I can think of one case. I was reminded of watching Larry Lessig on Blogging Heads earlier this week. Lessig had a case before the court, and he actually clerked for Scalia,
right.
And he really thought he was going to win this case on copyright extension. Based on a strict constructionist argument, and he was very disappointed to see Scalia rejecting that argument, and truth be told, so was I. They're not perfect. However, I would much rather go with their imperfection than the Warren courts.
So, but God, we both agree that Justice Scalia is not perfect. Is that it?
Yes. Okay. Yes, we do.
Okay. Heritage and the Nation are coming together on that.
There you go. moving away from justices, but still on McCain. In celebration of Cinco de Mayo, John McCain unveiled a Spanish language version website, which, of course, Michelle Malkin just loved. And McCain also will be also announced that he will be speaking at the National Council of La Raza's annual conference. And this is for every amount of good he may have done with his judicial nomination speech. This is a big stick in the eye to mainstream grassroots conservatives. Michelle Malkin had a great post later in the week. Top 10 reasons why McCain should repudiate the National Council of La Raza. I'll just name three. Number 10, La Raza supports driver's license for legal aliens. Number 8, La Raza opposes cooperative immigration enforcement between local, state, and federal authorities. And number 1, my favorite, the National Council of La Raza means the National Council of Race, for God's sake. So we'll see when McCain speaks at that conference if there's some distancing or, as Michelle says, some repudiation, denunciation going on along the lines of right. It should be fun.
Well, the first thing that jumps out is, of course, as I understand it, some of these blog critics and definitely some of the folks out in the conservative immigration movement are telling McCain he shouldn't go speak there at all, right?
Right, definitely.
Like, and so that's funny first, because these are the same folks that are always giving the Democrats a hard time about how every Democratic candidate should go on every Fox News show no matter what, and they have their concern trolling advice for the party, which still seems to fool some people in Washington, and they say, well, the Republicans told us we should do this, so it must be a good idea. Meanwhile, they're advising their candidate not only to close out Latino media. I don't know what his outreach is there.
Whoa. They're not inviting to close out Latino media.
They're not saying don't only go on Latino media, and I say I don't know what his outreach is there right now. He did just cut a television ad in Spanish, so clearly he's trying to take to the airwaves, and reach people.
Right,
let me just say, they are also saying, oh, don't even go to a large Latino organization, regardless of policy, don't even speak there. They're going to have to, square that hypocrisy, because he's got to speak to all kinds of voters if he wants to make a case.
Yeah, see, I don't see the hypocrisy there. Bloggers, Red State ran a campaign, Patrick Graffini joined in, to try to get the Republican nominees to go speak to the NAACP forum in Baltimore. The conservatives are not against Republicans engaging in minority media or going to meet minority groups. It's which groups they choose to do so when they do that. And it's the National Council of La Raza specifically that conservatives have a problem with, especially considering McCain's history.
Is there a Latino group they prefer?
The National Hispanic Business Chamber. They love them.
The Business Chamber. Is there a grassroots or membership organization they prefer?
No, I don't know off the top of my head, but definitely not La Raza.
I mean, I think that, again, there's a policy argument there, and you can make it. I understand people disagree with La Raza's positions, like any other policy group. Heritage has lots of positions, and some people disagree, but they still have a dialogue. But they're a large enough group and
it's true. We get Democrats all the time. John Tester was here just 2 months ago.
There you go. But they are, I think, clearly a large mainstream force in politics that's probably, although I can't speak for the McCain campaign, that's probably why he's going in the first place.
It's the mainstream part that we're disagreeing on. And conservatives don't think La Raza should be mainstream. And I guess, you know, people at the Nation do.
I'm not speaking for anyone else either, but let's dig in on that a little bit. Is it that they don't want it to be mainstream, so they are trying to balkanize and separate and divide and push the group to the side? They don't want the Republican candidate lending his credibility to create that reality? Or is it truly that they don't perceive La Raza as a mainstream group for Latino Americans? Because that is a pretty odd claim for anyone who's followed this political movement.
No, I'm gonna go with both. They don't think it should be mainstream, and they don't think it is.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Last one on McCain is VP talk. There was a flurry. I don't know if it was necessarily started by Bill Kristol's article in the New York Times, but it definitely picked up afterwards, suggesting Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, former House member also, for vice presidential candidate. And Kristol writes that no fewer than four McCain staffers have mentioned Jindal as a possibility, and the sell would be this. You want generational change? You can get it with McCain-Jindal without risking a liberal and an inexperienced Obama as commander-in-chief. I would say that after McCain spent considerable time with Jindal in New Orleans recently and reportedly found him, as he had before, personally engaging and intellectually impressive, that the campaign's informal name-dropping of Jindal began. And this has kind of received mixed reactions in the conservative blogosphere. Some people some people against. I'd say about half and half. Ramesh Pranuru at the corner says Jindal wasn't experienced enough. Catherine Lopez also at the corner says he said he's more needed in Louisiana. And Ross, who's also a big Jindal fan, said that, you know, this is such a bad year that Jindal shouldn't run, and that losing as a vice president has never been a good space to then go on and further your career.
Yeah, I mean, the most interesting part about Ross was he sort of slipped in the fact that he thinks there's a good shot McCain loses. I thought that was the most striking part of the analysis.
Oh, no, I mean, Bill, I, you know, mentioned all the week with Bill. I don't think McCain's going to win. I don't think a lot of Republicans do. There are definitely people that, you know, that do. Hugh Hewitt definitely thinks McCain's going to win, and there are definitely a lot of conservative bloggers out there who are bullish on at least McCain's chances. But I don't think it's that hard to find prominent conservative bloggers that think McCain's going to lose.
Hmm. Well, that makes me want to ask you a question.
Sure.
Before I, you know, get into the pick, which is, you know, do you think that creates a different set of metrics or expectations around what his campaign should be? Because everyone knows, not usually the presidential level, but plenty of people run long shot campaigns to get things done through the campaign, House races, primary challenges, that can be very good for the long term for issues or the movement, but are likely to lose. But that's a different orientation for your supporters and the choices you make than the big show, a presidential race. It's been a long time, I think, since we've had someone, in either party in a race really treating it like they're probably going to lose and making, you know, more bold decisions accordingly. Well, do you think that's it's at that level, or you wouldn't go that far?
Within the McCain camp and John McCain, no, they definitely think they're going to win. The whole reason they're going to La Raza, the whole reason they're making all the Spanish media stuff is because, you know, they think they can go out and win New Mexico. They think they can challenge Obama in Colorado. And I don't want to make the impression that there are people inside the McCain camp that don't believe. They're true believers.
Mm-hmm. No, but yeah, I mean the conservative blogosphere and the conservative grassroots from your experience.
Yes. Not so much. No, I mean, look, you know, I was talking to a guy from a veterans group, and he was talking about all the great candidates they're finding, And so I asked, you know, well, how come none of them are running this cycle? And he said, well, because we're telling them not to. And, you know, that's very true. If someone asked me whether or not they should run a House seat or a Senate seat, I would tell them not to this year. This is just a terrible year to go out and get slaughtered if you're a Republican. So, you know, McCain has some special branding that allows him to go against those headwinds, and he thinks he's going to win. But, you know, if I had – not even a close friend. If I had just giving honest, objective advice to anyone who was thinking about running, or any Republican, that is, if I was a Democrat, I'd say go for it.
Even like a MySpace friend, you'd probably say that.
Right. But any Republican running, I said, you know what, why don't you just go ahead and wait 2 years?
Yeah. Okay, interesting. Well, you know, to Jindal, who is, by the way, I think by any account, a pretty exciting politician, unusual for the Republican Party, 36 years old, running really during a tough time in his state, and despite his youth, winning people over, it's always interesting to see those kind of politicians because it's unusual. Very hard for McCain to pair up with, and I don't say this as a criticism of him, but with anyone who is so young, 36, to be president when, of course, we know that John McCain is going to be making an experience argument against Barack Obama, the presumptive nominee for the Democrats. So I just don't see it as viable given the choices the McCain campaign has made thus far. But I think there's incredible room for him for McCain to pick someone similar in that they're relatively new to the national stage. I don't know if they need to be that young, but they need to have relatively few years as a national Republican figure and instead be someone who comes with a freshness and a message that can complement what John McCain is saying, which is I'm a different kind of Republican in a different kind of year. But that doesn't mean we need to go all the way over and embrace the Democrats' plan for change. I can be changed, too. And we've seen that, obviously, this is not brilliant analysis. We've seen that for months, every candidate try to co-opt the change message one way or another.
Yeah, and, you know, I think Jindal would definitely be an option. It's like I said, the name's definitely out there. I wouldn't be surprised if it happened. But there would be some people in the conservative blogosphere, particularly the Club for Growth that I shouldn't mention before, but I'll include that link too, which looked at Jindal's trade policy and found him to be a little too protectionist for their concerns. So, you know, if McCain wanted to please some people and stick in the eye of some more of the, you know, ideological groups like Club for Growth, Jindal just might be the ticket for him. Do you want to skip ahead to your comments on black activism online?
Sure, let's do it.
You had the post on this. Go right ahead.
Sure. I mean, there was a Washington Post article here recently that profiled Color of Change, which is a grassroots organization, somewhat modeled on MoveOn.org, although that's a simplification, that unites black activists and black bloggers and other folks interested in black issues of civil rights and Katrina. Basically Katrina reform and FEMA, which they've done a lot of work on, and also media reform because they were intimately involved with a larger Netroots effort to scuttle the Democratic debate hosted by Fox News, which was successful in scuttling it. We spoke about that briefly earlier in this session. So what was interesting to me is, of course, many folks have been following Color of Change for a while now. Obviously, when the Washington Post does a serious treatment article, that's sort of an alert in the Beltway. I don't know what led to the article, but I do know that because Color of Change, along with labor groups and other Netroots activists and a lot of money pouring through Act Blue, the blogger fundraising portal, they were able to defeat incumbent Congressman Al Wynn, who was a member of the Congressional Black Caucus. They supported the candidacy of Donna Edwards, which they stressed at the time was their first endorsement ever. Color of Change as a grassroots group is not like a Beltway group that's doing a lot of endorsements. They're doing other types of activism, but they did make an exception and endorse her in a primary. Everyone knows you don't make friends with either party in Washington by getting involved in those primary battles. And yet we're seeing this increasingly in the Netroots and across the Democratic Party as a way to create more fundamental change, especially, I think, with the complete disgust with the Democratic majority in Congress failing on so many issues from Iraq to constitutional rights to oversight of domestic spying and other important issues to the Democratic base, and really I think to a lot of Americans, Iraq being an example where it's not even political anymore, it's just a question of a failure of several branches of government. So What you see in the Washington Post profile is a real awareness of this group coming of age. What you see in the Congressional Black Caucus, I think, is more awareness of these groups. And the question, like any time you have new power, is, you know, is that a relationship that leads to an alliance? Is it something a little more competitive? The Washington Post dug in on their contrast to the NAACP, of course, being a more litigation organization. No real comparison there. The NAACP being around for several decades and having done such fundamental work and sent people to the Supreme Court. But that's what they played up. What I actually think and what I've written about is real, the more the fight, the political dispute or contest, maybe a better word, is between Color of Change and the Congressional Black Caucus. People forget the majority of the Congressional Black Caucus backed Senator Clinton. It was by no means monolithic in supporting the candidates of the same race, nor should it be. But, of course, what we've seen is Barack Obama, over the campaign, consolidate support among grassroots activists in the African-American community who have then pushed back. They have a superdelegate pressure campaign as well. So I think there's a lot of interesting stuff happening there. It's of course, tipped off by Internet organizing, but it comes back to the same fundamental issues, which is, you know, who represents you. The other post we're going to link to there is from Spencer Overton talking about how for decades there was what he calls a Malcolm Martin model of leadership, real top-down and often church-based leadership in the black community, and that some of what Color of Change is doing is changing that. Not to replace it, but obviously to augment it, or in the case of Al Wynn and Donna Edwards, to put forward new candidates and do it themselves. So I think it's a fascinating thing, and something that is really, I would say, if we can criticize a lot of the broadcast media, completely lost. I mean, I don't think most people would know about this from the you know, months and months of television coverage we've had, which have talked about race, but only in the broadest of terms, not about activism based on issues of concern to African Americans and civil rights in general, this being a great example of that.
Well, I found the article only kind of marginally interesting and as a case study of the larger kind of new media phenomenon.
Then I guess I spoke too long. If it was only marginally interesting.
Let me say this. You know, you also wrote a piece on the story, I believe, and you framed it around the Wynn Edwards race, and you included a picture in there of people of Color of Change with a big dorky looking white guy named Matt Soehler, who we know and love. But Matt wasn't then mentioned in the article at all. He was just kind of there in the picture. And I guess what struck me about that is that the story just wasn't that special or different than any of the other kind of new online activism, new medium phenomena that we're seeing. It's not that different than the relationship between the Netroots and, you know, the DNC and the Democratic Party. It's not that different than, you know, the terrain that, you know, sports teams, baseball teams, football teams are dealing with bloggers who cover their sports, or in the case of the Wizards, Gilbert Arenas, who's, you know, blogging for them. You know, it is, you know, interesting, you know, as a case study, looking at the specific movements, whether it's the NAACP or, you know, Jesse Jackson, and seeing how that played out and how those dynamics are working in that specific field. But I didn't see anything kind of new or special or different that's not happening in you know, pretty much every other sector. It seemed to me, you know, just a pretty much classic Netroot story, but just, you know, with different names attached. I mean, especially with Wynn and Edwards, who are, you know, huge favorites of the larger Netroots. So, you know, ACT Blue was involved from the beginning. You have the picture of Stoller in there. Stoller, Bowers were on there from the beginning. You know, Daily Coast, Atrios, they were all big Edwards fans from day one. So I always saw that as kind of just a larger Netroot story, and not necessarily a you know, African American civil rights story.
So that makes you sort of like the TV pundits.
I guess let me
take a second try, because another way to hear what you're saying is the piece I wrote, or what I just said, didn't nail it enough for you, and that you saw it as similar to rather than distinct and important. Let's drill down on what it means to challenge a congressional district that's held by an African-American member of Congress. Well, let me say.
How is it different or more special than, you know, like Connecticut Senate Lieberman?
Sure. So let me go. Number one, when you talk about members of Congress who are from African-American communities, you are often talking about communities that were systematically repressed and disenfranchised for hundreds of years, and only through the civil rights struggle and the gerrymandering cases and the minority districts that were finally drawn to beat back the dilution of many minority voters over decades, did you finally get, in many cases, African-Americans representing those African-American communities. And not all the districts are the same. The Maryland district is not the same as a district down in a Reconstruction area. But if you talk to a lot of the CBC, there's a very different feeling, I think, about what it means to represent those districts, what seniority means. I mean, you have people like John Lewis who marched with King and hold that district. And you go into those folks and say, we're challenging your district in primaries because you don't represent the community. I think it has a whole different valence than other areas that have primaries and people in and out all the time. So that's not to say that it's morally better or worse, but the political significance and the pushback you get and the way the CBC has stuck together on this, much to the chagrin, I think, of a younger set of African-American activists, but understandably, I think when you look at where many of those people have come through, the crucibles they had to come through for politics, I think it's fairly different than Joe Lieberman and Ned Lamont in Connecticut. There's a different historical experience. There's a different understanding about what incumbency means. And if you talk, by the way, to folks, this is true across the political spectrum, in politics about incumbency, it's a dirty word. It makes people think of corruption. You look at the decades of organizing across the spectrum around term limits, which ultimately the Supreme Court said was unconstitutional. But it got that far precisely because conservatives and liberals felt that leaving people in Congress for 30 years with a reelection rate over 90% was not functional democracy. That's a whole set of understandable complaints. But it's totally different from folks who say, well, yeah, our incumbency came from getting a minority district that truly represented the community that wasn't gerrymandered and diluted for the first time 25 years ago, and someone still represents that seat. Incumbency is a very different context. So yes, I think it's one of those situations where not race as a petty skin color obsession, but rather the history of race, the history of the marking of those districts is really a different texture. I would imagine it's fair to say probably my article and the Post article both failed to get into that level of detail, but yes, that's part of why it's so different.
Fair enough. Speaking of race and change, how about we move on to Barack Obama and his efforts to unify the party?
Okay.
Did you want to highlight what you liked from this Matt Stoller post, and then I'll talk about what I liked?
Well, in the spirit of equal time, I feel like I just went off, so maybe you should go if you have something.
Okay. Well, Matt has a list of kind of stuff that Obama is doing to already kind of unify the party, and I thought some of the passages were particularly telling. First, let me say that I agree with David Axelrod and all the Democrats that say this long campaign has been great for Democrats because it's engaging the party in states like Pennsylvania and Indiana, making people interested and involved, building the donor lists. Matt makes that point. I agree completely. But then he goes on and talks about what Obama campaign is doing beyond that. I have heard from several sources that the Obama campaign is sending out signals to donors, specifically at last weekend's Democracy Alliance convention, to stop giving to outside groups. He goes on. He has bypassed Act Blue and will probably end up building a congressional slate feature to further build the party and keep control of the data himself. Moving on. It's actually very similar to Clinton from 1994 through 2000, where power and money in the Democratic Party is being centralized around a key iconic figure. He's consolidating power within the party. By stripping power, money, responsibility from outside groups and opponents, Obama is increasing his control of the party apparatus, which I think is all dead-on accurate, except for the part where it's some type of something new or change. Stripping everyone else of power within a movement and centralizing within yourself is common to everything from the Jacobins to and Robespierre to the Bolsheviks and Lenin. And to the Republican Party and Karl Rove.
You had to get Lenin in there, didn't you?
I got Lenin in there, I got Robespierre, and I got Karl Rove. I thought it did well. No, it's classic politics. You take over control of the apparatus of the party and concentrate it centrally within yourself. It's not new. It's not change. It's how politics has been done since forever. But yeah, it's unifying the party around Obamaism, and then as Stoller later goes on in the rest of this post, he really, really hopes Obamaism is like the progressivism he believes in, but he's not entirely sure. Mm. We'll see how that works out for you guys.
Mm. I think you hit it on the head. I mean, there's a real tension there between what it takes in practical politics to suit up and get on the field for this general election fight, which I think is going to be very tough, especially with what we've seen in the primaries, which is a swift vote media on television that treats Democrats fundamentally different than Republicans. Don't take my word for it. Go back and watch all the debates in both parties. Go read the Project for Excellence in Journalism reports. Go look at the scrutiny of the candidates. It's just not even close. That's, I think, just clearly demonstrated. And so it's going to be tough, because Obama's going to be running not only against John McCain, he's really, in a sense, going to be running against a media that is already predisposed against Democrats in presidential races, not, I think, on every issue, not on social issues, but on a lot of the national security and corporate discussions in a presidential race. And second, he's got a real problem here with a media that is threatened by the way he routes around them. And I think that, of course, agrees with what you're talking about. Routing around traditional power structures includes for him often routing around the media filter and doing the direct speeches, using YouTube, using the social networks, raising this money in a different way that has upended a lot of the politics in the establishment, but has also led people questioning where their role is. Howard Kurtz actually had an interesting article about this, about the press feeling shut out and not understanding how he was doing well, but not using them like traditional campaigns do. All of that, I think, is basically acceptable if done correctly. What concerns me, the part that you mentioned as attention, is if it's totally personality-based, and it is, as you say, centralizing authority to the point that the bottom-up activism and the grassroots enthusiasm becomes a tool, becomes something to deploy, but is not a living, breathing, organic part of the movement and does not have authority and power within the campaign and within, hopefully, for many of its supporters, ultimately within governance, then, as you say, that's a big problem. I think it's way too early to tell. I think the discussion about money and fundraising, by the way, is also premature, because we just don't know. And we'll know when we see where the money goes to third-party groups or more to Obama. But what we do know is that there's always a fine line here between being very excited about a candidate, a personality, building a movement around the person, but also staying true to the values and the policies that matter. A lot of talk about Ronald Reagan on the right to this day, built around his unifying personality.
If I can just stop you right there, just to explain something, is for anyone that's lives in or works on the Senate side of Capitol Hill, you know that Heritage Foundation is under a considerable amount of construction. So I'm actually in colleagues of mine office, not my own office. This is just to explain the large Reagan poster over my shoulder, which I figure since we were mentioning him in an iconic way. It would just be weird not to mention the fact that there's a large bust of him over my right shoulder. He's looking over me literally right now.
Yes.
So I'm not my office. Just thought I had to mention him since he's kind of overlooking this right now. But go ahead.
Yeah, and I was, to this day we talk about Reagan Democrats. Well, if they voted for Reagan and they continue to vote for Republicans, they're probably Republicans, first of all. But second, we're not just talking about an ideological shift with those people. We're talking about something that connected them with Ronald Reagan. And for Republicans, that's a good thing. And of course, Obama talks a lot about getting these Obamacans. And we see in some states, Virginia being a prime example, a lot of Republicans went over and voted for Obama, even while McCain
was... I was one of those Republicans, although I did it for kind of less than pure motives.
You did it in a Rush Limbaugh chaos mode?
I did. Well, it's an open primary.
It's funny you mentioned that, because that's a whole separate issue. But what I was gonna say is that Virginia is a state that matters in that respect, because Rush had not fully dialed up that program with the same intensity at that point. And McCain and Huckabee were still in the race. Huckabee drew a lot of votes in Virginia, so the type of folks that were just looking to protest McCain were still going to Huckabee. And yet, at that juncture, Obama drew a ton of new Republicans. I've written about it, so maybe we'll throw that link up too. And that's significant. As we got later, of course, and McCain was a presumptive nominee, it's harder to parse out which Republicans are genuine, which are like you doing, bad faith voting, and which were motivated by Rush Limbaugh or someone else. All of that is to say that Obama has a very good thing going with this focus on his personality and what you call Obamaism. But of course, he has to find ways to show that he's still communing with the base, really, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, and I guess, since we're comparing him to Reagan, and we're not the first ones to do it. Obama did it himself. Reagan definitely was different, had a different model. Reagan did not try to centralize the conservative movement around himself. That's a completely separate issue of whether or not after he left office the conservative movement tried to centralize it around him. Mm-hmm. But, through his, first campaigns, he came to CPAC in 79 and said, I'm one of you. You guys were here before me, but I'm part of you, and we're going to win this together. You guys have made great progress, and there definitely was and still is an identifiable movement, of which Heritage is a big part, that is clearly identifiable and separate from Reagan, and Reagan never tried to centralize it and take it away. Did quite the opposite. He basically told Heritage Foundation, could you write a bunch of policy ideas for my first, term in office, the mandate for leadership, and Heritage did that. And we had our fights with Reagan over the years, but it was definitely more of growing the larger movement. So far, I'm not the only one who has yet to identify a core group of issues that is Obamaism, that is separate from the cult of Obama.
I object to the word cult, and I think this is an intelligent environment, so we should avoid that kind of high-heated rhetoric. But I agree with part of what you're saying. I would parse it out as, number one, the issues around, is there a movement and is he responsive to it, separate from his candidacy? And then number two, what are the issues and policies that animate Obamaism? I think you're dead wrong to claim that there's no issues there, but we can get into that. But number one, I think you are right, that there's a real question about, as you say, to take the Reagan example, who is his Heritage, who is his CPAC? It's not like progressives have not been building these institutions. The Netroots, have one of the most important conventions on the entire left now, and all the candidates came and spoke at it last year, and Obama came, but he has, as everyone knows, distanced himself from many of the leaders of the progressive blogosphere. He does not.
And as Matt Stoller points out, he's bypassing Act Blue.
Say again? I'm sorry.
Oh, and as Stoller pointed out in that post, he's bypassing Act Blue,
right,
not only for his own fundraising, but for fundraising for other candidates.
Right, and that's that routing around that I was talking about. I mean, when I say routing around the media, I don't mean one slice of the media. He is, as much as possible, and it's been successful in the primary, routed around all media, old and new. I mean, they are not going to bloggers and saying, here's what we're doing, I hope you treat it positively. They're going right to their networks on Weibo, on MySpace, on YouTube, on Facebook, and saying, here's what I'm saying, watch me unfiltered. And it's worked very well, particularly we've seen it work well even when he's been under strain. That's in a primary. We all know it's going to be very different in a general election, and swing voters are not going to be signed up on those networks. So it is different than a primary. But it's important to win the primary, and he's doing that, and he's routing around. But as you say, he's not commuting, I don't think, as much as he should with those groups, whether you talk about the Netroots is one, Campaign for America's Future, a large liberal progressive conference that just happened.
Oh, just that Bill, works with him and ran their conference here in the same hotel that CPAC holds their conference in.
Yeah. And Center for American Progress, which was, like a lot of institutions, roughly, I think, by the end, divided between Obama and Clinton people and started by some early Clinton people, but I think has been a wonderful laboratory of ideas. If he's doing close outreach to CAP, we're not hearing about it. I'm sure that, of course, the relationships, Lawrence Korb, for example, is a former defense official at CAP who advises the campaign. But what you and I are talking about is the movement side and the interaction you get with the progressive, or in your case the conservative, but with the groups. Particularly, let's be clear, the groups that are not super partisan, but rather have issues and ideas that they care about. You know, so that's number one. I have a number two, but if you want to respond to any of that.
No, I think we're agreeing on number one.
Right.
Why don't you go ahead and go to number two, and then we'll wrap it up, because the guy whose office this is will be coming back soon.
You got it. Number two is there's absolutely a clear, defined set of principles around Barack Obama's candidacy. They're partly why he's winning, and they're definitely going to come into clear, you know, very clear vision when he's running a general election against John McCain, because they're diametrically opposed to John McCain. But it's clearly a different kind of foreign policy, an opposition to the Iraq war that was grounded in an aggressive view of focusing on the stateless threat of terrorism, Al-Qaeda, and like-minded. Let me run through, because we said, what is Obamism? Let me run through it.
Okay.
I might make you nervous when I tick off all the policies. But yeah, it's number one, that original, initial, and consistent opposition to the Iraq war, part of a broader foreign policy framework. You go down and talk about Cuba, conventional wisdom is, oh, presidential candidates have to support the embargo. President Clinton signed the Helms-Burton Act. You know, this goes back a ways. No, Barack Obama says, I do think we should try to break the embargo and have a different relationship with Cuba, even though they have human rights abuses and problems and we don't support their kind of government. We need to have more diplomacy, particularly against the kind of small states that do us a lot of harm in the international arena, but don't necessarily pose a security threat. And that's a differentiation that his advisors talk about, in addition to dignity promotion, which is a looking at the threat with regards to what people around the world see of the U.S., think of the U.S., and how they are going to become the part of the stateless threats of tomorrow, or be prevented from that. So it is a nuanced and specific foreign policy, and it's something that made him, you know, differentiated in the Democratic field. I don't think anyone would say that if Barack Obama, you know, was for the war in the Senate and voted for the war, that he would be the nominee. So that's number one, and foreign policy is important. Number two is a theory of open participation and open government and open democracy that really taps in to what a lot of young people in independents feel that government is shut off to them. It's the parallel financing structure he talks about, and not being beholden to lobbyists, which picks up on themes from John Edwards. And it's basically saying that the system is so broken that we have to change the entire way we do politics to get progress. It's not enough to think about these as siloed issues. We have to change politics. But when you look at the details there in campaign finance reform, you know, he's co-sponsored Senator Feingold's bill on that, which would take us further than McCain-Feingold and break some of the power of special interests in campaign finance. In an open, transparent government and using the tools of the internet on that. And you mentioned Larry Lessig earlier, who's involved, you know, in supporting Obama and pushing those ideas out. And obviously, although I think less important and overhyped, in changing the way we do politics, which is everyone's heard about when he says we're not going to do the same old distract and attack politics. But it does matter, because we can have a debate about the war and the economy, or we can have a debate about campaign jewelry, and the product of that debate will be very different. So those are two. I realize I just went on for a while. But number three, on tax, the economy, and jobs, John McCain and him are diametrically opposed. They both agree. And I don't think there's any confusion about that. So there are clear planks to Obamaism that people are excited about.
My response would be this. You know, we were talking about this in the sense of, you know, there was identifiable conservative movement that had an ideology, and is there such the Obama campaign? And, you know, you identify, you know, foreign policy, you know, changing Washington, and different than the idea of McCain. Yeah, he definitely has a different idea of McCain of domestic policy, but he also talks about, you know, this kind of new new politics, and, you know, we know he was, you know, for ethanol subsidies. We know he, you know, supports, you know, clean coal subsidies. There's not really a sense of really, you know, what the coherent part of that domestic policy is. As far as your other two points on foreign policy and change, you know, ever since Watergate, we've been changing Washington with campaign finance reform. And the only thing that's happened is we've made it harder and harder for upstarts to get involved, because you have to spend so much time campaigning because of the absurd limitations on speech. And, you know, Obama's only going to make this worse. Unless, of course, you're as famous as a rock star is, and you can raise, you know, millions and millions of dollars online. But, you know, Obama's the exception that proves the rule in that case. Not, you know, look at Larry Lessig. Larry Lessig declined to run because his name ID was so low. And so when you have people who, you know, realize they're going to have to spend tons and tons of time raising money, as opposed to, say, if we had another system where George Soros could identify, you know, 10 really progressive people he wanted to run for Congress, write them big fat checks so that they could spend all their time instead of raising money out talking to voters. You know, that'd be a great system according to conservatives, but progressives are against that. And so is Obama. But, you know, we'll see how that works out. And finally, on foreign policy, I just don't think there's much coherence there. I mean, I talked about this New Republic article by Crowley last week, and I think we should. And yes, Obama was against the Iraq War from the beginning, but, you know, we don't really know what he's for from that. We don't really know what his model out of Iraq is going to be. And we don't really know how he is going to deal with Iran and these other countries, besides this vague idea of some meetings to begin with. So all that, you know, really hasn't been hashed out in the same way that, you know, we knew exactly what Ronald Reagan was going to do about the Soviet Union and the Cold War and the rest of it. So I think there is a lot of fuzziness as to part to, you know, what is Obama's ideology. And you think it's going to be a tough fight. I think it's going to be kind of more of a coasting. But it seems as though we're gonna find out what that is.
Well, let me just take a big step back. I identified three key points of Obamaism in
foreign policy, domestic
policy. In contrast
policy.
To the claim that nobody knows what he stands for, there's nothing animating it besides what you call.
I wasn't saying nobody knows what he stands for. It was that. Because this all came up in the context of Reagan taking an already existent movement that had an identity and using it and being successful and leaving it beforehand, as opposed to Obama not taking an existent net roots progressive movement, but instead creating his own movement. So it's not that there's nothing identifiable policy-wise about Obama. It's just that there's no specific, movement of issues around him that he is building and growing through other institutions, etc. That is identifiable and will last beyond him.
Okay, but even with that clarification or elaboration, I named three things, and on two of them, you proceeded to disagree with the ideology of them, which is perfectly fine. We disagree on a lot of these issues, although we can talk them through. But I don't think you got to the heart of the point, which is there are there, and people do see them, and there are major tenets to this that are basically animating Obamaism. Now, to your third point, where you actually did contest whether we know what it means, I actually haven't read that particular Crowley article, but I've heard this before. Obviously, you know, the general election is a time to continue to parcel out these exact ideas. But I think that Barack Obama has been basically more specific than most folks that run for president in a primary in talking about his views. And he's taken political risks. There's also this idea out there of, oh, he doesn't take risks. You know, it's a big risk for a Democrat to talk the way he has about engaging, you know, dangerous parts of the world and the power of diplomacy, harkening back to JFK, something that other people disagree with. And that's fine. But that wasn't easy, and that was distinct from Iraq. And I mentioned the Cuba example, which is a distinction obviously not only with McCain, but with the last Democratic administration. So there's a lot of conventional wisdom on foreign policy that he has specifically publicly rebutted. And then what you hear is it's not enough, it's too vague, we don't know where he stands. And I guess sometimes I feel like, well, I guess some people will say that no matter what, and they should be, you know, people have to be called out if that's just their refrain. But he has been specific, I think, on that, and I think that talk is still relatively cheap. So the reason why people care about Iraq, and when I say people, I mean the reason why voters prioritized that for Obama, was because they saw that as him taking a position before something happened. And it's easier to come back and rewrite history or do future hypotheticals, but that was an example of him taking a stand. I don't think his whole campaign is or should be based on it. But yes, that matters, and he's, you know, articulated this, and maybe it's a whole other hour session if we want to just do his foreign policy against McCain, who, by the way, is pretty vague, only he's scary vague, because he talks about a very long military presence in Iraq. He still talks about blurring the threats of terrorists and the Iraqi government and the insurgency, which are distinct, and we need a president who understands that. So, you know, this is obviously, we could go on, it's a whole other topic, but I do think Obama's, you know, sketched out a clear plan here.
We are going to have to leave it there. We can obviously talk more about this, and we actually dropped two whole other topics that we planned on covering. So maybe we'll have to do this again sometimes, but I have to go. I had fun, Ari.
It's great talking to you.
We'll have to do this again sometime.
All right. Thanks, Scott, and thanks. Okay.